appreciate that. You want to pin this on me? Thank you so much. I don't know how I'm going to die. I used to tell people that I was going to die of white lung. I've inhaled so much chalk dust over the years. I also might wind up electrocuting myself. But I'll tell you one thing. I am thrilled, deeply thrilled to be back in Texas. I love it here. I remember the very first time I ever came was in Longview. I landed in Shreveport, and as we drove over the border into this magnificent state, I became well aware that the heart of the Texan is as big as his state, and I have jumped into a lot of hearts here. Thank you for having me. Ladies and gentlemen, I would begin tonight by giving you a tiny little insight into the heart of the alcoholic. A therapist at a treatment center was walking down one of the corridors and saw an alcoholic patient on his hands and knees with his ear up against the wall. And he thought it slightly strange, but said nothing and went on his way. 3 hours later, the fellow's still there, hands and knees with his ear up against the wall. 2 hours after that, he's still there. So the therapist thought, well, there must be something on the other side of this wall. He got down on his hands and knees and put his ear up against the wall. 20 minutes later, his back is starting to kill him, and he looks at the alcoholic and says, I don't hear a thing. And the alcoholic says, neither do I. It's been that way all day. I was down in Atlanta with Dr. Hunter in December and heard a magnificent story from a pilot from one of our commercial airlines. You'd be astounded at how many pilots there are in AA. You'd be terrified if you knew about it before they got there. Anyways, he told this magnificent story of a football game being played by the animals of Africa. The rhinoceros team was playing the zebra's team. So the zebra lost the toss and kicked off. And the rhinoceros lost and kicked off. The zebra grabbed the ball and started upfield and got tackled at the 3-yard line. And at the end of 3 downs, he had gotten nowhere and had a punt. Well, of course, being a zebra, he's a pretty good kicker. And he put it into the opposite end zone. That old rhino grabbed it and started upfield. No finesse, no class, no broken field running. He just barreled straight ahead, knocked over 11 opponents, and scored. And that's the way the game went. Halftime, it's 56-0. Favor the rhino. So they come out for the second half, and the zebra kicked off. The old rhino grabbed it again in the end zone, got out to about the 6-yard line. Boom! He went down as though somebody had shot him with an elephant gun, and it took him a little while to get up. Well, meanwhile, everybody on the zebra's team is saying, who hit him? Who tackled that rhino? And a tiny little voice from down the ground said, I did. And they look down, and there's a helmet about the size of a half dollar. So they lifted the helmet, and under it is a centipede. They said, you tackled the rhino? He said, yes, no problem. They said, well, where in the world were you during the first half? And the centipede said, putting my shoes on. Got to get ready. Now I'll tell you a true story. Some years ago, an acquaintance of mine, a recovered alcoholic doctor, was sharing an incident that had happened to him in his home several years before. He was a long time sober, and he lived in his home with his wife and his wife's mother. The children were all grown, married, and gone. And one evening, he and his bride got into one of these marvelous family hassles that happen every now and then. You know how they begin. Who left the lid off of the, or left the cap off the toothpaste, and it took off from there. And they were having a wonderful old screamer. They were yelling at each other and so on. And the mother-in-law entered the room and entered the argument. And she began to recall to him everything that he had ever said or done to her daughter during the drinking years. And as this went on, both he and his wife were shocked, and then they were appalled at the vehemence of her anger and at how accurate her memory was. They had long since all but forgotten some of the things. They had certainly resolved all of them. The mother-in-law kept at it. She was recalling entire weekends, whole conversations, word for word, that had happened years ago. And this went on and on, and she was approaching hysteria. Her voice got louder, it got shriller, and this went on for about an hour. The two of them just stood there with their mouths open, listening to her. And she wound up almost hoarse. And she screamed this out at the end. She said, "Besides all that, I hate you." And he said the only thing you could hear in the room was the three of them breathing. And he looked at his mother-in-law, and he said this, "I am so sorry to hear that, because I love you." He disarmed her completely. She burst into sobs and cried for as long as she had yelled. And he said from that moment on, he and she began to develop a very lovely relationship that they enjoyed at the moment of his telling about it. Ladies and gentlemen, if I may, I would like this evening to just make a few comments about human emotions. I live with a family, as perhaps many of you know. I have been with Tommy and May Abraham for almost 10 years. May handles everything I do. And I remember some years, about 5 years ago, saying to her, "I'd love to do a talk about sobriety. You hear enough about alcoholism, let's talk about the healing, the good part, the recovery." And she said, "That's nice. And the emotions." And one time I said, "I'd love to do a film on gratitude. We talk about it in AA so much." She said, "And the emotions." And every time I'd open my mouth, she'd stick the emotions in there. And one day we had some words about it. I was saying, "How am I going to get emotions in all these things?" And May sat me down one day and said, "Let me tell you something, Father. It's one thing to get sober, and it's another thing to handle your hatred and your anger and your hostility. It's another thing if you are the spouse, man or woman, of an alcoholic, to bury your anger, your hostility, your hatred, all those magnificent feelings that every one of us has." But before I begin, I'd like to make some opening remarks. Number one, I am not a professional psychologist. Now, that has advantages and disadvantages. I do not know all there is to know about emotions. Nobody does. Nobody does. I don't have a technical knowledge of much of it. I know as much about emotions as any one of us who has ever gone through college has been given in general courses. Well, I'll tell you this, I know what I've learned from people like you through the years. And the big advantage is that you won't hear any technical language. I just don't know any. I just don't know any. The man who saved my life made one of the most profound statements about human emotions I have ever heard in my life. He said, "Emotions are what we have the most of and know the least about." I think he was right. Second thing is this. Every single one of us in this auditorium is going to die feeling guilty about our feelings. And I'd like to say right now that feelings are neither moral nor immoral. They're there. What is a human emotion? I believe that a human emotion is a response to a stimulus. Flip a switch, lights go on. Flip a switch, lights go out. Strike me or stroke me, praise me or insult me, I will feel, I will respond to that. I have no control over that. And yet I feel guilty about some of my feelings. See if you hear yourself in any of these comments. I didn't love my mother as much as I should have. I didn't love my father as much as I should have. I hated so-and-so. I always loved one child more than the others and didn't dare let my feelings come out, or I tried to hide it. Have you ever in your life felt this? God, I wish he would just die and leave us alone. Just die. And then you could crucify yourself for even daring to think such a thought. Now, I've thought those thoughts. And if you hold a membership card to the human race, you've probably thought a few of them too. What am I responsible for? Not the feeling, that's a response to a stimulus. Bring me a picture, I see. Make noise, I will hear. Bring a rose, I will smell. Food, I taste. Hit me, soothe me, I will feel something. There's no control over that. I am responsible, morally responsible, for the subsequent action. Someone I dislike enters the room, I have feelings of hostility. That doesn't mean I'm a saint or a sinner. Someone I love walks in the room, I have feelings of affection. There's no more moral good about that than hostility produces moral badness. A feeling is an immediate response to a stimulus. Now, cultivating a feeling like that woman did, I am responsible for that. Someone I dislike enters the room, I feel hostile. But if I punch him in the nose, I'm responsible for the punch, not the feeling. It's the subsequent action. And that is what I have to pay attention to. My thesis for tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is a very simple thing. We'll get to it in a second. That incident from the doctor's life showed one person reacting with hate and another reacting with love in a given situation. Now, I believe, and I think that this is, it's one of the devices that the textbook writers use, all human emotions somehow can come under both of these headings, the love feelings and the hate feelings. Under love, think of tolerance, compassion, sympathy, forgiveness, joy. Under the hate feelings, think of everything you can think of negative, intolerance, a lack of sympathy, antipathy, sadness, depression, anger, fear, depression, all of those so-called negative things. This group we call positive, good, constructive. Over here we call these bad, not necessarily morally bad, just bad in the sense of negative or destructive. And my point tonight is this. I'm not going to overemphasize the love feelings, but let's look at these so-called negative, bad, destructive feelings. My thesis is simplicity itself. Handle them, or they'll handle you. And I have a responsibility to handle my own feelings. Ladies and gentlemen, no one else makes me happy or makes me unhappy. I am responsible for me. And this is why so many of us cop out. I drink because my wife divorced me, I just heard. I'm unhappy because of my job. I determine basically whether I am a happy or an unhappy person. Now, why do we call these things good, constructive, positive? Why do we call these things negative, bad, destructive? Simply because all of these love feelings not only produce, but they reflect an inner happiness. And these things are called negative because they produce and reflect an inner unhappiness. Depressed, angry, sad, hateful people are unhappy, and lovers are happy. Why? Why? Simplest reason on earth. You and I are built to love, and love has an object outside of self. I love you. Every one of these feelings, these love feelings, picture them as coming out from the word love like spokes from the hub of a wheel. I am tolerant toward your shortcomings. I forgive you your offenses against me. I am compassionate with compassion to suffer with. I'm compassionate toward your misery. I am sympathetic. Why really have the professionals robbed us of that word and stuffed empathy down our throats? Sympathy is a lovely virtue. It's a good thing. It means to suffer with. I take on your pain and I weep with you. Every single one of these feelings looks towards someone else. They are all other-centered. Now listen to the negative feelings. Anger, grief, sadness, depression, intolerance. They produce unhappiness because they're self-centered. They are completely self-centered. We're born to die, right? People die by the tens of thousands every single day somewhere on this planet. Doesn't mean anything to me one way or another. Until I lose someone. And I'm not really concerned about the death. Why did God take this child? She was only six. Well, that little child who was taken at the age of six is spared a whole lot of misery on this earth. She's with the God who created her. She's where she belongs. Why am I upset? Because of my grief. I'm not condemning that. It's kind of normal. But the emphasis is on me and my pain. I'm not saying that people, places, things, and occurrences can't affect me. I'd be stupid to presume that. You can contribute to my happiness, and you can contribute to my unhappiness, but when the final curtain is rung down, I am responsible for me. I am. They use this example. It rains. One man's happy and one man is sad. Why? The happy man has been praying for it and it comes. The farmer who needs rain. The sad man wanted to play golf and can't. Ladies and gentlemen, rain is rain. What's the difference between the two men? The attitude towards the rain. I personally prefer this example. I'm walking down a street and I see a friend approach me. I speak to him and he walks up and without a word, he smacks my face. Now, I'm going to cry. And I'll experience all kinds of feelings. Number one is surprise. Good heavens, he hit me. I will be very sad. My friend hit me. And I'll be angry. He hit me. And I'll weep. Every single one of those reactions is perfectly normal. Something would be wrong with me if I didn't have them. Something would be wrong with you if you lost a child and didn't weep. My point is this. If I'm weeping because I got slapped, if I'm crying 20 years from now, that's not my friend's fault. It's mine. It's mine. It's like kids, runaways. I'll never forget this. Priest from Manhattan. You've heard of him. Father Bruce Ritter takes runaways in, fights off the pimps at the door, takes these little teeny kids in. He said every now and then they'll find out where the kids are from. They'll call home. The parents say, don't send them back. We'll call the police. 13 years old, abandoned, absolutely abandoned. Some kids can rise above that and become doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. Other kids use it a cop-out to jump into drugs. The only thing you can say to a kid is, so your parents don't love you. That's unfortunate, but it is a fact. Now, you can either handle that or it'll handle you. Depends on what you want to let it do to you. Ladies and gentlemen, the sad part about these negative feelings is that a lot of them occur and the feelings are justified because the things did happen. Here's a wife who can say, that man did get drunk and beat on me for 15 years. These things did happen, and I hate him. Well, ultimately, I am responsible for me. And I think it should be in the minds of all of you parents and lovers and brides and bridegrooms to be, you will not make another person happy or unhappy. You can contribute. But how many of you have set out to make a man happy in marriage or to make a woman happy in marriage and find out after 15 years the whole thing is a disaster, an absolute disaster? You've tried, you've done this, you've given that, and so on. And somebody winds up completely neurotic and so forth. How many of you have died for your children and they wind up in ways that you wish they hadn't? And your question is always, where did I go wrong? I should have made him happy. No. I am responsible for me and you are responsible for you. Bill Wilson's famous question that brought AA into being holds the clue to all of human nature. He said, I wonder if I might not get sober by trying to help another drunk. Ladies and gentlemen, fulfillment occurs as a result of commitment to others. Lovers are happy people. Haters are unhappy. Now, all this is lovely and it's theoretical and it's classroom stuff. Now, let's get down to it. Think of somebody in your life, let's say a parent or perhaps a grandparent, if you can remember back when you were a little bitty kid. Someone, even in your life today, whom you absolutely adore. You just love them. You love it when they come to visit. You're sad when they leave. You love to just be in their presence. You love to hear them talk. You just love to be near some people. There are other people you like to leave when they come around. Why? Now, you don't need a PhD for this. I think that the answer is so simple. You know why you like some people and don't like others? You like some people? Hold on to your dentures. This is profound. You like some people because they're nice. They're nice. We like nice people. And we don't like some people because they're not nice. What makes somebody nice and what makes somebody not nice? Ladies and gentlemen, it is so simple. Nice people are other-centered. They care about you. Remember your grandmother when you were a little bit of a boy or girl and you went to visit her? Hi, honey, how are you? What have you been doing? My, that's a pretty dress you're wearing. What did you get for your birthday? You. Other-centered people are nice, and we love to be around them. And listen to these. You know, the sad sacks. I. Shut up. You ever met people who are most miserable when they have nothing to be miserable about? They're tongue-tied. They don't know what to say. I know people who dwell on grief. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not condemning her, but I can remember when I was a little fella, right next door to our house, we lived in a row house, one of the famous row houses in Baltimore. And I used to run errands for the lady next door. Both she and her husband are long dead now, as are my mother and dad. Mrs. Hampshire had two children, a boy and a girl. And the girl, Kay, married when she was about 30. She was a tubercular. And this was long before the miracle drug era. And Kay married and only had a few very happy months of married life. And I remember it was in the summer. And Kay and her husband walked down their steps next to us, and I could see them going by. They were going up to the movies three blocks up on 36th Street. And 2 minutes later, he came running up the street holding her in his arms. She had begun to hemorrhage, and within a matter of days, she was dead. Now, Mrs. Hampshire and Mr. Hampshire and her brother, all and her husband, their grief was normal and natural. Until the day she died, my next-door neighbor, on her own birthday and every Christmas, would give herself a present. She would wrap it up and so on and write a little card. from her deceased daughter, Kay. Now, I'm not condemning her for that. I'm just saying that's what she did. But she kept that grief alive. She wouldn't let it go. And it cast a shadow over her relationship with her husband and her son and everybody else. All she could talk about, she would come next door to my mother and say, look at the pretty scarf Kay gave me. It was as if Kay were not dead at all. Look at the pretty scarf Kay gave me for Christmas. She was allowing that feeling, which she hugged to herself, to control her. Now, that was just grief. Suppose I do that with anger, with jealousy, with hatred, and with hostility. Handle them or they'll handle you. Let me give you two cases. For 4 years of my life, I was privileged to be chaplain to the first order of black nuns in the United States. They were based right near our college, and we priests served as their chaplains. At every mother house, you have nuns who are there studying. You have little novices who are learning and entering convent life. And you have the old nuns who are preparing to die. Their work is done and they're worn out. There is one nun there, Sister Georgiana. Blind, bad heart, arthritic, and diabetic. Those four things were for starters. They were for starters. I used to love to go up to the infirmary after breakfast in the morning just to visit them. You could always tell where Sister Georgiana was. She whistled. And she always had a joke. The world's worst, but she always had a joke. She was a happy woman. Please, you think of the person in your life that you love to be around. Examine the life. It's full of pain. It's full of a whole lot of heartache. And yet they're happy. My own mother. We could always tell where she was. She hummed. My mother hummed. Whatever she's doing, the wash, getting supper. My mother hummed. We always knew where she was. There was another nun there. Ask her how she was. She told you. You ever met them? Hi there, Henry. How are you? Oh, geez, I wish I hadn't said that. Because out it comes, you know. And it always began with this. Always. I didn't sleep too well last night. And I always wanted to scream, who cares? I don't care. Hey, look, if I ever ask you how you are, don't tell me how you slept last night. I just don't care. We're in the midst of inflation and economic recession, and you didn't sleep well? I just don't want to hear that. She would go through a whole litany of woe, and after about 8 minutes, I'd be way down the corridor turning the corner. She's telling me about her arthritic elbow. We don't like to be around people like that. Nobody likes self-centered people. We just don't. We just don't. I don't want to hear I, me, my, mine. I don't want to hear that, neither do you. It's like an ingrate. No one can stand an ingrate. Even a five-year-old. Give a five-year-old a present, and if he doesn't say thank you, say, a little twerp. And it may not be his fault, because he may not have been educated or trained to do that. We despise ingratitude. We despise it. And we hate self-centeredness. We just hate it. My mother, God bless her, she had one of the strongest things she ever said in her life. You know, if you, even in a joking way, paid yourself a compliment, she used to always say, self-praise stinks. And it does. It does. It does. Nobody likes self-centered people. Now, before we get into how do we handle these things, one question quiz. Are you nice? You can answer it in a minute. Do people like to be around you? Do people like to be around you? Or are you a loner? And is the fault everybody else's? I am responsible for me. Now, are you a nice person? You can find out very quickly. You can find out very quickly. How do, I shake your hand, you shake mine. How do you do? How are you? There are three things about me that are going to indicate to you what kind of a person I am. I don't mean judging one's moral character. I'm not talking about that. And there are three things about you that are going to let me know what kind of a person you are. Looks, talk, and action. Appearance. How important is it? It's not overly important, but it plays its role. I once heard a fellow say, well, I mean, your appearance doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference what you're wearing. It's the person inside. Yeah, but the person inside determines what he's going to look like outside. Forget all the philosophical stuff. What I'm trying to say is this. If you look like a slob, chances are. We were just talking about appearance tonight, about appearance on the part of counselors and professional people. I think it's important. Would you pay any attention to a man in a business suit directing traffic? He better have a cop suit on, right? All right. What you do, your actions and your speech. Primarily your speech. It gives you away. You want to know what kind of a person you are? Have someone tape you for one day. And then listen, you know, have them pick a day out that you're unaware of. And you will hear, my friends, you will hear whether you're an I person or a you person. Just for fun, can you think about today? Are you a different person at home from what you are when you leave the house? Is there a front for other people? Do you remember what you sounded like today? If you deal with the public, do you remember what you sounded like? I remember one time May and I went over to a local store. We took a vacuum cleaner to get a new cord put on it. And the lady behind the counter, her business is to deal with people. She must have eaten 19 nasty pills for breakfast. Have you ever seen people look like they're sorry, they're glad? She looked that way. She looked that way. It's rather crude, but it's very accurate. She looked like she could smell it, but not quite locate it. If you want to, you can find out exactly the kind of a person you are. Just listen to what comes out of your mouth. Are you an I, me, me, gripe, 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 gripe person? Or are you genuinely interested in other people? And once you come to that answer, you'll find out why folks like to be around you or why they don't like to be around you. Some of the most attractive people on earth would never win a beauty contest. They're just lovers. Now, please, how can I change if I'm not one? Can I take my own angers and hostilities and griefs and sadnesses and intolerance? Can I change them around? Yes. There are three agencies at my disposal: God, others, and self. Now, God. You know, it absolutely astounds me that therapists who try to get sick people well, they call themselves scientists, and I'm not denying that. The word science comes from a Latin word, S-C-I-O, scio, means to know. And a science is a body of knowledge in any given area. All knowledge, the human mind is made to grasp truth, ultimately truth itself, God, or whatever label you want to put on it. And it stuns me that so-called scientists aren't ultimately reaching toward God and using him as a base of all healing, but nonetheless, what role does God play in human existence? Ladies and gentlemen, we hear so much talk of the miraculous. The miraculous is extraordinary. I have a right to pray for it. I do not have a right to expect it. Well, if your faith is deep, you can move mountains. I can see God up there saying, what do they want me to toss hills around for? Just... It is my personal, passionate belief, along with hundreds of millions of other people, The role that God plays in human existence is He gives us the strength to do what needs to be done. Every now and then He tosses a miracle in. For example, when this is over tonight, you could pray that He waft you back to your home. And you could keep praying for that. But I don't believe He will do that. I believe He wants you to drive the way you came. And I believe that's perfectly normal and reasonable of Him to expect that. I'm dead serious about this. I'm not joking, even though it sounds kind of corny and ridiculous. I do believe this. If I were to pray tonight to the good Lord to make me a physician by 9 a.m. in the morning, He could. I have no doubt of that. He could. I just don't believe He would. I really don't. And I believe it would be stupid and foolish for me to pray for that. Dear God, please make me a physician. Fine. Go to med school. What else? This is... Isn't that right? All right. I've heard people say, oh, dear God, remove this hatred from my heart. You remove it. Is that person saying, it's in your heart, not mine. Dear God, you make me more patient. Do you know how God handles the alcoholism of the alcoholic? He gives the alcoholic the strength to not drink. Then He gives him the means to exercise that strength, the 12 steps. Guess who does the steps? The alcoholic. How does God remove these negative things from my life? In step 7, we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings, all of this garbage over here. How does He do it? He gives us the strength and then the opportunities to exercise it. It's up to us to use them. I always say this at meetings. Some guy comes and says, oh, what a day I had. I had a flat going to work, and while I'm looking up a gas station, somebody plowed my car and totaled it. I was late getting in. I had a fight with the boss. He fired me. I was late getting home, and the wife and I had a horrible fight. Burned dinner, and I cut myself shaving and scalded myself in the shower. Boy, do I need a meeting tonight. What a horrible, horrible day. Some old pro in the back of the room says, sounds to me like God gave you about 22 opportunities to grow and you blew every one of them. Now, does it make any sense for me to ask God to remove my shortcomings? Yes. It also makes sense to me to know how He's going to do it. He's going to give me the strength to do what needs to be done, then I've got to do it. So what do I get from God? Strength. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm dead serious about this. If you depend just on human strength or your own emotional maturity to get over hatred resulting from the fact that maybe your husband was guilty of incest with your 12-year-old, it's going to take a little bit more. Now, you may like this and you may not like this, but we need the grace of God to function. And if you don't believe, make believe. You better start someplace. And if you have no God, borrow mine. He's been helping me for a pretty good long time. But I think you need strength that is other than human. Just reach out and ask for it, whether you believe or not. Just reach and ask. It'll come. See, He can function without our understanding of it. Number 2 is human help. This is all important. God, please listen to this, please. One of the deepest convictions that I have in AA is the utter, absolute necessity of having a sponsor. And any man or woman in AA says, well, I don't really have one. I've been sober 104 years, and I just use the group as my sponsor. If that's a type of living that you are satisfied for yourself, be my guest. You know what happens when you bring a problem to a group? You're going to get a minimum of a half dozen answers, and guess which one you're going to pick. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think of yourself? What do you think of yourself? What are you worth? Now, I'll tell you what I'm worth. I'm worth the best. And if you ain't got it, get out of my way. I'm going to find somebody that does have it. You know the principle I operate under since I got sober? Margarine covers the bread, but it ain't butter. And I like butter. What kind of a life do you want to live? What kind of a life do you want to live? Now, here is another principle of human psychology that you very rarely hear, especially from those who teach it. No one is judge in his own case. I need you. I need you. That's the way I'm built. We depend on the TV for the news. We depend on shopping centers for clothing. We depend on supermarkets for food. I need you. That's the first lesson that the battered alcoholic learns when he enters AA. I am helpless.